Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're bringing you part two of our Reddit duplex cult saga. Go back and listen to the last episode if you don't know what I'm talking about. And if you're back for more, thank you so much for being here.
We love, love, love you.
My main sources for this episode are archived articles from the Tri-City Herald, reporting from Kristen Kramer for the Tri-City Herald, the docu-series Ministry of Evil, The Twisted Cult of Tony Alamo, directed by Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, the 1987 article by Lynn O'Shaughnessy for the LA Times called Alamo Foundation Sparks Concern Again, Saugus Residents Wary of 60s Religious Group, the September 2008 interview with former cult member Elisha Frankowitz by Sion Rue for the Oregonian titled Inside the Arkansas Compound, Tales of Abuse and Neglect, and a Reddit post on the subreddit Legal Advice.
We want to thank our newest five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. We got Annie Motel, Cupcake 13, Heather M., and Kristen M. Your kind words fill us with joy. Mm. Thank you so, so much to our recent one-star reviewer. We love you too. Thanks to everyone who rates, reviews, and interacts with us on all the wonderful podcast apps out there. Our Spotify ratings and subscribers are showing us love. We don't have your names, but those stars mean so much. Same with everyone across the globe who listens on Audio Mac. Mm. We love our Audio Mac listeners, by the way. If you're listening on Audio Mac, you know, and I get it, you're Gen Z, and it would be so cringe.
Quit saying Gen Z.
I'm just saying, they're youngsters. Episode. You know what I'm saying?
No, just stop. I'm
chasing youth, Muriel. Kill
you
me.
Can read. You know what it's I mean? Very obvious.
I'm just saying, DM us, man. We love you, Audio Mac listeners. Okay, special shout out to IpsoMati1971, who hit us up on YouTube. Any and all sharing of Muriel's murders, both on social media and in your friend groups and families, is so, so meaningful to Muriel and I. That is a major factor in our ability to have the show reach the goals we've set for it, which is to quadruple. We want this show out there booming.
Set your intentions.
You know what I'm saying? All right. Anyways, if you guys like the show and you share it with the people in your lives, we appreciate you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. This is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like little old Nick and they don't want to hear about those things, go listen to a different podcast.
We'll probably do a little cursing and joking. So if you're sensitive to that, turn us off and hit me up, man. I'll put you onto a playlist of all this really great music I've been listening to out of Australia lately. Shout out to all my Australians. You guys are doing some weird indie freaking bedroom pop, whatever. I'm on board, man. And there's not a lot of joking, not a lot of cursing. So you know what I mean? If that's what you're looking for in your life, I'll send you some Australian music.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay, let's get started. We left off last week with Susan Alamo's death. After years of having pretend cancer, Susan got cancer for real and died at the age of 56 in 1982. This left, who most considered the lesser, dumber, and arguably eviler of the two Alamos, in charge of the foundation.
Lesser, dumber, and eviler. That's fucked up. El Tony Dum-Dum Devil himself.
Tony Alamo now had the keys to the kingdom. His first act would be, wait for it, to raise Susan Alamo from the dead. Mm. Mm-hmm. Susan's daughter, Chris, said of Tony, quote, "My mother made him a multimillionaire. She couldn't do much about making him a man, but she made him a very rich psycho."
Good for her. She's brave, too, leaving.
I know.
Yeah, she's super brave.
She's a great speaker. Tony refused to bury Susan and instead dressed her body in a fancy wedding gown and kept her body in the mansion where he ordered his followers to pray 24/7 over her corpse in 2-hour shifts for the next year.
Is it too early to say that that is a little bit of what Angela did to her mother, Claudia, keeping her in clothing, looking pretty in her apartment?
What's so weird is like, I didn't get that until I was going over all of the notes for this episode. Yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
We're connecting dots over here. Just like, what's his name from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Or everyone who tries to connect dots in the history of Mad Men.
Yeah.
Or not Mad Men, but meaning Mad Madness. Men.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But not the TV show.
We're all doing right. Good. Good banter.
All right. So back to the story. Tony refused to bury Susan. Mm-hmm. Everyone's heard about it. According to a 1987 LA Times article by Lynn O'Shaughnessy, the most requested song at their local Arkansas radio station during the time of Susan's attempted resurrection was Wake Up Little Susie.
Wow. Was that a trolling thing?
I don't know.
Or you think people were thinking like, really, let's play this song and it'll
help. I could see Tony telling people to request the song. But I also could see them not having access to telephones and it being a super trolling thing of the neighbors around who knew that he was keeping this corpse in his mansion.
That would be so fun to go back into a time where you could really talk shit by calling your local radio station and requesting songs. And it actually worked.
That made my eyebrows go straight up. I could see Tony instructing it, but I actually can't see those guys having the access to be able to do
I hear what you're saying.
And
I
get with you. Really funny.
It's a horrible, very good troll.
Susie's daughter Chris later said, "I had a cow when I found out he had her in the house." All right, little children, serious things.
I had a cow that was like cutting edge at the time.
It was. Little children weren't exempt from the prayer duties. The smaller kids would pray, like nightmare fuel, pray over Susan's open coffin for months.
Right.
In fact, surviving members of the cult say as the months went by with no resurrection, the children were routinely beaten for not praying hard enough for her resurrection.
Yeah, and then you turn into an adult and you hear a child cry and you just beat the wall.
When the resurrection was revealed to be a complete failure, Tony screamed at the congregation, blaming them for Susan remaining a corpse and basically saying it was because the children had the devil in their souls. When Susan's body started rotting, he moved her body out of the mansion and to a mausoleum so she could still resurrect if she felt like it. After Susan's death, a number of people left the cult. She was very much more like the heart of the cult than Tony was. Mm-hmm. And Tony at the time, before like Tony's decades long reign over this thing. Mm-hmm. And Tony put the ones who stayed around under complete lockdown. Most were given a $5 a week salary for their full-time labor. They had to ask Tony for everything. They couldn't even buy a pair of shoes without his permission. And Tony also started arranging people's marriages. Tony Alamo had all the children on the compound calling him Papa Tony. And throughout the late 1970s and 1980s, Alamo used the children as child labor in homegrown sweatshops to make his increasingly popular Tony Alamo sequined jackets.
Oh, that sounds like, Walter Goggins from Righteous Gemstones.
Yeah.
Wow, not that he was having child labor, but that he was just like a flashy guy with like a signature sort of like look that perhaps could be perceived as cheap by some people.
Yeah. They were these rhinestoned, airbrushed monstrosities made by children. and they sold like hotcakes. Like these handmade jackets were flying off the shelves, and they were really popular with celebrities. Like Brooke Shields was photographed in them. Dolly Parton.
No, Dolly.
Mike Tyson.
Not Mike.
Mr. T.
You're naming all of the good celebrities.
And Michael Jackson.
Oh, man. Well, he would just probably... No. He was running he was running out of sequins to wear. So okay, you can't blame him for that. He's like, I've already worn every sequin that this globe has to offer. Who's making sequins? Someone's like, I don't know, here's something from Arkansas. He's like, all right, wear it.
Okay, great. Tony preferred the children to make the jackets because their tiny hands were more efficient at sorting rhinestones.
It's crazy to me that the wife was the heart of the operation when she also beat her own daughter into oblivion.
She was beating everybody's kids.
She was just, and she was the heart.
I think that she actually knew how to preach. I'm not convinced. I don't know. I mean, this is also from the perspective of a certain group of people. Like Tony Alamo is the name. When people talk about this cult, they talk about Tony Alamo because, spoiler alert, he was around for until like 2010 or something like that, 2012.
Oh, wow.
Like a long time doing terrible things. And so,
whoa.
Like, she died pretty early into the operation.
Yeah.
She was like the heart of the operation before she died.
Well, it's very early in terms of like pre-internet and pre like modern distribution of celebrity.
Right. And the things that Tony Alamo will talk about, like obviously very shortly, but the things that he did were also so much more overtly like evil and terrible. So like,
More overt than beating people?
Well, like in the guise of it being this religious institution, right? Like corporal punishment is...
You're right. That's like day one. That's
no, like I mean, normal. it's around in a lot of these old school institutions, sure. Right? Okay. And that's like a part, spare the rod, spoil the child, I believe is a Bible verse. So like, it's not like that is so alien, even though it's horrible and it's obviously like gratuitous and a gross misinterpretation of... you know, religion and all of those things. Mm. It's still within the wheelhouse. Like the stuff that Tony graduated to doing is like barely Bible-esque.
You know? Barely Bible-esque.
So.
Some might even say satanic. Okay.
Under Tony, the disciplinary beatings of children got worse. In the Speck House, which was the name for Tony's mansion on the compound, there was this room that people went to for mandatory reporting. So Tony fostered a culture of surveillance. If you saw someone doing anything against the rules, you had to report it. And that meant, you know, children reporting on each other, children reporting on parents, parents reporting on children. If you didn't report and you got caught by someone else, then you could be reported.
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
For the kids, the punishment for an infraction was a brutal paddling. Whenever there was a paddling, Tony would call in to the reporting room and then instruct his followers to put him on speakerphone. A larger male cult member would hold the offending child in the air while another male member held the paddle and Tony would command them to chop wood. They'd use the paddle almost like a baseball bat and administer the beating while Tony would listen over the phone.
It's horrific.
It's horrific.
It reminds me of like the reporting thing. Remember we did that episode, I think it was an exclusive episode way back about that teacher that thought it would be an interesting experiment to teach fascism. To teach fascism and how much reporting is a part of dictatorship.
Yeah, yeah. That was such a fascinating episode.
Yeah.
So at this point, this is where we come back to our Reddit story and Angela Greiner. Tony Alamo's story unfortunately continues well into the 2000s. And we'll wrap that up in a minute, but here in Arkansas, right now, in the mid-1980s, is the only time I could find Angela Greiner's name mentioned in any sort of newspaper article, right? She didn't even have a birth announcement, which we're assuming is around 1975. This is the time period Rebecca Gay, who was also born into the cult in 1975, describes in her 2005 blog post, Rebecca Remembers Abuse by Tony Alamo. And I'm just going to read you some excerpts of Rebecca's post that I found. When I was 2, my family was moved to Arkansas. I remember when I was 5 and in kindergarten in Dyer, Arkansas, 1980, Tony and Susie would make frequent visits to this school. Tony was our principal. I remember his paddle. It was big and had holes drilled in it, and I was told the holes made the paddle move more air and was supposed to make it sting more, which was the goal. I remember Tony Alamo himself coming and beating kids severely from everything from talking back to a teacher to bad grades, so C's, D's, and F's, to lying or cheating on tests. I think it was at that time when I consciously realized I was not safe. I saw other kids beaten and I was terrified. I remember Carlos and Miguel getting beaten with an actual horse whip. I recall sitting in the cafeteria eating dinner when Eric Ondersak came back from the spec house, Tony's mansion. We moved over for him to sit down and he physically was unable to sit down. In 1986 and 1987, I was at the spec house in Arkansas several times when Tylon Willis, Aaron Willis, Tyrone, Benji Risha, Jared Balsley, Jason Balsley, Katie Decker, Angela Greiner, Kimberly Ondersak, and maybe a few others who at this moment I can't recall, were ordered to be beaten by Tony Alamo. They were beaten for disrupting class, making jokes during teaching time, bad grades, and talking. Now, when I say beaten, let me just paint a picture for you. One large man would get on each kid's limb. That's right, one person holding each arm and each leg. For those who can't count, that means 4 adults holding these kids suspended in midair, while another adult takes a board and beats them a number of times issued by Tony Alamo. In case you want to know how the count was kept, the kids had to count their swats, and if they lost count, the count would start over. Tony had a thing for the number 40.
Jesus Christ.
So Rebecca went on to describe how Tony escalated to paddling adults and then introduced this thing he called smiting, where anyone, child or adult, who made an infraction would have to stand still while someone punched them in the face. Rebecca said she was the victim of smiting 4 separate times as a child for asking questions about a Bible verse. So with all of this, right, in 1988, Tony managed somehow to go a step too far. So we talked before about how the kids were a part of the coercive control of the cult, right?
Yeah, bargaining chips.
A bargaining chip, right? And there was one particular boy, this boy Justin Miller, who was adopted by cult members in Miami. So basically, cult members in Miami were out kind of like expanding the cult and trying to recruit people and doing things in Miami. And this little boy kept coming to the church services alone. He was 5 at the time. And his mother was disabled. She was a single mom, and he was kind of running wild, and they invited him to come to the cult back to Arkansas for a 2-week vacation. His mom said yes. And while he was out of town, his mother died. And so he was an orphan, and they managed to be able to legally adopt him out to 2 cult members. His name was Justin Miller. So Justin Miller grew up from 5 to 10 in the cult, and then basically his dad didn't know about some of the beatings. He hadn't had a little kid, and he was working outside the cult in a trucking sort of situation. Mm-hmm. And so his wife knew about the beatings, but he didn't know about the beatings. And when he found out, he was like, I have to get Justin out of this cult. And they basically, he was with his brother and they were leaving the cult, trying to figure out what to do. And as they're running through the woods, the people from the cult started shooting at him. Mm. And so he ran off and wasn't able to grab Justin at the time. He came back to try to get Justin, and his wife saw him and sort of screaming for guards. And so he had to run off again without Justin. And one of the most horrible things about these parents who escape the cult without their children is that it's like very widely known that Tony Alamo would have their children severely punished. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So after Justin's dad tried to get him out of the cult, Justin and his mother were exiled out of Arkansas back to California. There was still, the compound was still kind of operating with a skeleton crew back in Saugus, California. And so they went back to the old compound, and there he brought Justin Miller into this little room, and in retaliation for his dad running away, because they said he still loved his father, so he had evil in his heart. Mm-hmm. He was paddled in this manner 150 times. And by the end of it, there was blood everywhere. He ended up making a full recovery, mm-hmm. but it was just horrific. Like, he didn't recover for a very long time.
Yeah, it's
time.
Like just mutilation. I mean, yeah, what even I mean, is that? Yeah.
It was just real. I mean, 150 times in yeah. that manner, you can imagine how horrible that was.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening was Justin Miller's dad was able to get enough witnesses together to file, to have charges filed against Tony Alamo for felony child abuse.
Mm, good.
And
good.
At the time that these charges were, it took a few years, but sure. at the time the charges were going through.
Did they get Justin out quicker than a few years?
You know, I'm not sure. I think that maybe it was like 89, mm-hmm. you know, and this was 88, so mm-hmm. maybe a year. But Tony Alamo, because of some financial reasons, went on the run and was convicted in absentia of felony child abuse. And then the judge awarded the Miller family a $1.5 million judgment. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, he definitely at least got
the family. So the mom got the money? Who's in on the beatings? You don't know.
They name them both. Uh-huh. You know, in the stuff that I've read. Is
well,
the,
it's hard
the father
to say
the
that the mom's in on the beatings because she's also being coerced. And
she thought she
crazy.
Was going to hell if she didn't right, do it. And right, the beatings yeah. are literally, they're coached to think that they're beating the devil out of the children. So yeah. they're doing it out of love. So the more you love the child, the harder you hit them. Right. So that's like mm-hmm. a part of the built-in mm-hmm. mechanism of it.
Yeah, I mean, anything better than a spoiled child.
And it's horrific. So a bunch of stuff went down. Basically, the government saw all of this insane, obviously for-profit businesses in yeah. this, you know, church, right? So the government eventually revoked the Alamo Foundation's tax-exempt status, and Tony was ordered to pay about $19 million in back wages and about $8 million in back taxes. He served some time in prison on financial charges, and then in 1998, he was released from prison and successfully restarted his church in another part of Arkansas. In 2007, Tony's church was deemed a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center because he really hated Catholics. I don't get this at all. Then he was like super like not into the Vatican and the Pope. And he was distributing all this like hate literature about Catholics. And so that's what he got in trouble for. Not the beatings, but you know, whatever. I mean, fine. Great.
Yeah. It seems like he'd be a hate group against children also.
Yeah. So that, but that's what sparked that. And then around that time, Tony also scammed victims of Hurricane Katrina out of donated mattresses.
Oh, great. What did he do with the mattresses?
He sold them. They donated them and then he tried to sell them as a profit, which I just thought was so chintzy and ridiculous, but then also like, oh, he's in the modern history, the modern era.
Yeah,
like,
right. Well. Yeah, it's amazing.
He has something to do with Hurricane Katrina.
He made it that far? Right.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, crazy.
In 2008, Tony's new Arkansas compound was raided by police after an investigation into Tony regarding child pornography and child abuse. By then, he was a public advocate of polygamy. And in 2008, he actually told the Associated Press, consent is puberty. That's his.
Oh, wait. Meaning as soon as you reach puberty, you've given your consent?
Yes. Like your body going through puberty is consent.
Is consent.
Yeah, which is horrific when you think about
it. Yeah, no, I mean, just when you thought it couldn't get much worse.
Yeah,
just ratchet up a notch.
Really ratcheted
up. What happened to him? You're going to tell me. Yeah. Okay.
So he had started taking multiple wives back in the early 90s. Eventually, Tony was convicted of taking girls across state lines for sex after five women testified that he had married them when they were underage, most of them young teens, the youngest being 8 years old. Tony Alamo was sentenced to 175 years in prison and died behind bars at the age of 82. Mm. So back to Angela Greiner and her mother, Claudia Kinney, and their lives in newspaper clippings. Like I mentioned in the last episode, after Claudia's 1974 wedding announcement, 15 years went by before I found another mention of her. According to an announcement in the Tri-City Herald, Claudia Kinney attended her parents' golden anniversary party in the Tri-Cities in 1989. The next time we see Claudia is in April of 1990. Claudia and her husband Mark Greiner's names appear in a long list of divorce announcements in the Tri-City Herald under Benton County Divorces. 7 months later, her name appears again next to the name Eric H. Nielsen in a long names in the Tri-City Herald, this time under Benton County Marriage Licenses. That month, on December 23rd, 1990, Claudia finally made the wedding announcement page. So she's very pretty and beaming in a white dress and a glitzy wedding tiara. Eric Nielsen is handsome, very solidly built guy with glasses and this Burt Reynolds mustache. And again, her wedding announcement says a lot between the lines. Most notably, neither of Claudia's sisters were in attendance at all, and neither were her parents, Harry and Catherine.
Who were all still alive?
They're all still alive, and they all live in Richland, and that's where she got married.
And they were not there.
No one was there.
Yeah.
But here, for the first time, Claudia's daughters, Angela and Melody Greiner, are mentioned by name as attendees. I think Angela would have been around 16 years old at this point, and Melody would be 14. In the 1990s, according to some newspaper ads, Claudia worked for her father's real estate firm, Spencer Kinney, as a relocation specialist. In 1994, according to the Benton County District Court listings, Claudia was arrested for DWI. I couldn't find any other information about that. As for Eric Nielsen, her second husband, I found his name three times in the Tri-City papers. Once when he applied for his marriage license, once in his wedding announcement to Claudia, and then once in a Valentine's Day issue of the Tri-City Herald under a large photo of him flirting with a middle-aged woman who was not Claudia. Mm-hmm. The caption read, Eric Nielsen of Richland and Susan Rudd of Kennewick chat Tuesday night at the Heartbreak Ball in the Pasco Red Lion Inn. The photo is part of a larger article titled Misery Loves Company at Broken Hearts Get Together. So the other photo in the article is of a long line of people in front of a paper shredder with love letters and photographs in their hands.
Oh, so the whole thing is like, yeah, my relationship is over. My heart's been broken. Let's meet someone new.
Yeah.
We're all in the same boat together.
Yeah. So full disclosure, I never found a divorce announcement for Claudia and Eric Nielsen, but I did find that photograph.
Interesting.
In 2000, Harry Kinney, the patriarch of Claudia's family, died. And in 2001, Claudia's youngest daughter, Melody, was married. This was announced in the Tri-City Herald with just her name and age and the name and age of her partner in a long list under marriages Benton County. In 2008, Claudia's mother, Catherine, died, and in her obituary, Claudia is once again referred to as Claudia Kinney, so she was back to her maiden name. Mm-hmm. After that, neither Angela Greiner nor her mother, Claudia, appeared anywhere else in the Tri-City papers until 13 years later in an article titled, Tri-City Woman Threatened Officials to Stay Away, Then Her Mom Was Found Dead by Kristen Kramer.
Brutal. It's brutal.
I know.
It's brutal.
According to the article, this is the non-Reddit story. Okay. So this is the account from police and reporters and stuff like that. So the non-Reddit story is Angela Greiner had become her mother Claudia's primary caretaker a bunch of years prior, right, to her death. And they'd settled together into the duplex apartment in Richland, Washington. Relatives told investigators that Claudia became suspicious of her daughter Angela, thinking she was tampering with her medication when most of her teeth fell out a couple years before her death. And that's according to relatives. Mm-hmm. In June of 2020, Claudia had some tests done at a local hospital. And then afterwards, the hospital was unable to contact her with the result. And ultimately, they received this letter that was ostensibly written by Claudia Kinney requesting that the hospital stop all contact and cease to try to get a hold of her for these results.
Wait, hold on. I don't, this tampering of, she's saying she's hurting me on purpose and that's why I lost my teeth. What do you mean? Or she's just bad at doing the medicine, so I lost my teeth?
According to these unnamed relatives that live out of state.
Yeah.
Claudia had called them like 3 or 4 years before all of this went down, saying, my teeth all fell out. I think Angela's tampering with my medication.
But, like, maliciously tampering, like, to hurt me?
Yes.
Okay.
And also, nobody stepped in to try to figure out what was going on, which I'm always like, why do people not do anything?
Well, so what strange. Unnamed relatives, too? That seems...
Well, like, that's kind of why I thought it was interesting talking about this legacy family. They're not listed anywhere. And Melody totally disappears. So she's not mentioned in this article by name at all.
Yeah.
And nobody else is. And this is a really famous family in the area. You know?
All right. So then
so
you're 2020, suggesting Angela wrote the hospital under the guise of, oh, I'm Claudia and please stop contacting me.
That's the idea.
That's the
Nobody
idea.
Knows sure. for sure. But okay. It seemed odd that Claudia would go to get tests and then write the hospital to say, never contact me again. In late January 2020.
Does that work also? I have a lot of people I'd like to just say, like the gas company, you know? Like,
I think you could tell them, you can't tell them not to get their money, but I think you could say, like, stop telling
me. I received your bill. Never contact me again.
Banter. In late January 2021, after Angela cut that large hole in the shared wall of their duplex, neighbors were hit with a awful smell.
Yeah.
The neighbors reported the incident to police and requested a welfare check on 67-year-old Claudia Kinney, saying that they hadn't seen her outside the home in about a year. Investigators found some unnamed out-of-state relatives who claimed also that they hadn't spoken with Claudia since August of the previous year. So nobody had heard or seen from her since, you know, the summer of 2020. An investigator from Adult Protective Services and officers from the Richland Police Department went to the duplex to try and contact Angela through the hole, which officers said smelled terrible. But Angela just screamed at them, refusing to get out any information about her mother and threatening to call the police on the police for trespassing.
Classic move.
Police returned on January 28th to, quote, bang on the windows, which I feel like that's a bad choice. That's what they said in the report.
I love the first time they're like, look, I'm going to kill you. See, I just said it. It's not the next time. Well, like, then the second time, just do the good old bang on the window.
Well, that's after they stuck their face in the hole and screamed at her from the other side of the duplex. She's just like, go away. And they're like, well, we'll go banging. Come on, man.
Hilarious.
Anyway, that was not well received. Angela refused to let them inside, screamed at them through the walls, and then left threatening notes on the door, windows, and taped inside the hole, reading, I swear I will kill you. Stay away from my house.
Okay, I'm sure the cops took that seriously.
No.
No?
It's like a no trespassing sign, but like creative.
Dear police, I will kill you?
She didn't say dear police. She just said what she said. Nobody was named, and she put them on her windows and said, I mean, you know, get out of here.
All right.
Police were advised they could possibly put Angela in an involuntary psychiatric hold based on her behavior. People were, you know, different investigators and mental health experts were saying she sounds like she might be having a psychotic break, or she was paranoid schizophrenic, but they wouldn't be able to put her in this involuntary psychiatric hold unless she came outside. As it stood though, they couldn't enter her side of the duplex without a warrant. So they couldn't go in and pull her out. They had to like stand out there and see if she would come out, and then they could put her in a psychiatric hold.
Yeah, you're not like, you know, criminally insane if you're just in your apartment.
Apparently.
Even if you're ruining your neighbor's lives and busting holes in the walls.
I mean, you could see
entrapping dead people inside.
You could definitely see why this poor person on Reddit was so frustrated.
Yeah, of course. Of course you could.
For the next couple of days, neighbors then started reporting sightings of Angela sneaking out of the house and taking a taxi to go buy groceries. But officers were never able to like catch her in the act. So they were like, she can't come out. And then she just would like, as soon as they would leave, she would come out and go get groceries.
Yeah, sure.
On January 29th, police went to the duplex to try to talk to Angela through the hole for the third straight day. Police were not successful and also found Angela had posted a fresh round of notes around the duplex reading, I will literally tear you limb from limb if you try to cross into here. Don't try to bang on the windows and door either. I have 9 abandoned kitties. You've upset very much. Signed, me. Through the hole, an investigator from Adult Protective Services asked, quote, if Claudia was still alive or if Claudia died. He said he, quote, attempted to sympathize with Angela and talk with her about how it was okay if her mom passed away and that people pass away. It's a part of life. And Angela just returned with, I have nothing to say to you. Some identified family relatives did come in from out of state to try and coax Angela out of the duplex via talking through the hole, but they were unsuccessful.
I mean, I could see myself traveling across the country to do that, but I'd be less inclined to do that if I also knew the cops just like didn't get her when she stepped out of the house at the same time every night.
It,
you know what I'm saying?
A little, it definitely feels like a little bit like, what's going on?
I just like, if she really never came out, I'd be like, all right, I'll go talk to her.
Well, they're also for days going and just yelling through this hole. Like, that to me just seemed so, I would be worried she would be stabbing people or like, I just feel like it's not a very good tactic. Bang on the walls and yell through the hole. I don't know. Police finally got a warrant and accessed the home on Thursday, February 4th, 2021. The Benton County coroner said it was hard to tell, but Claudia could have died as far back as October of 2020, depending on temperature. Damn. Yeah, so her body seemed like it had been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
Her autopsy determined that she died of complications from emphysema from all of her tobacco use. Angela Greiner was taken to a hospital for a mental health evaluation. The original Reddit poster wrote, quote, the last I heard, the daughter is living in an adult family home with a one-to-one caregiver at all times, like a one-to-one caregiver ratio at all times, and is doing a lot better. And the last thing I found about the family was a missing persons report from June 7th, 2023. Angela Greiner was considered an endangered missing person. She was listed as 5'4", 100 pounds, wearing a gray shirt and navy trousers. And the article stated she was suffering a mental health crisis and couldn't return on her own power. Angela was found a month later, and the missing persons alert was canceled. And that's the end of that.
Damn, what a rough go.
Yeah. It's so weird because when you learn more about her life, if that is her life, right? Like,
yeah.
Which to me seems fairly likely. Like, Angela Greiner's not, that Greiner is not even a really popular last name when you're searching through archives. There aren't a lot of Greiners, at least that I found.
Yeah.
In the states that I was looking at.
And the Times.
Mm-hmm. If it all matches up pretty well, and then you just look at that and look at the context of this like post on Reddit, it's such an insane thing. But then when you like read about what she, the scope of what she potentially went through, there's so many echoes from that, you know.
Yeah, keeping
justification,
keeping the body alive, the wanting to punish a child,
yeah, or wanting to punish people for hurting children, like the crying is the thing that set her off. And she was thinking,
right, she was constantly accusing past people of being child abusers and everything.
Yeah, all the tenants, she thought they were child abusers. And then it seemed like the baby crying really escalated everything. And you know, the original poster was saying that it was actually the first baby in 15 years that had lived in that duplex. Mm. So she hadn't been exposed to that sound in 15 years.
Damn.
Yeah. I don't have anything else.
All right, great. So that's what you did with your week. Good job, Muriel. Thanks, the internet. Jesus Christ. Can I have my wife back, please?
I've been here the whole time.
No, you're in
Do
your
you
own cult.
Do you know who you're married to?
You're in your own Muriel cult. Okay. The cult of your own freaking phone. You know?
Okay. Okay, buddy. I just feel like that's such a crazy story.
It's so crazy. Well, especially because it's this viral Reddit thing.
And then
it's just like, well, who were the people? And you're like, oh, damn, those were the people?
Yeah.
I mean, in this really tragic, sad way, is like, it makes sense.
Yeah, you know? A lot of it fits together.
But also in sort of this beautiful humanitarian way, I don't know, that's a weird thing to say, but it's just like, if someone's banging on your wall, I'm not saying don't protect yourself and protect
your
children.
Yeah, I mean,
children.
If somebody did a shining hole in my wall, I would lose my mind.
Of course. I'm not saying the original poster or any of the people involved in the situation did anything out of the absolute necessity, like reasonable thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't sound like those postings, they didn't seem to really attack
She didn't at all. No, right? No. Her main thing, the person who posted it was just like, she just needs help.
It's yeah, not, right. Of course.
She was not like, I mean, the situation was horrible, but she was not attacking her.
Yeah, anymore. No, she, absolutely. So the words coming out of my mouth have nothing to do with that original poster and her perspective or her heart or anything or her energy. But it's just like, just in this world, you don't know what the hell someone's been through.
Yeah,
you
right. Know what I mean? Yeah. It was very like, it was a very strange feeling to like sit there and have all of these pieces of people's lives in front of you, like this obscene sort of like removed internet story.
Yeah.
And then just like actually the structure of, you know, the most important moments in people's lives.
The woman who, Rebecca Gay, that was her name, who was in the documentary and everything. How is she these days? She seems like She's empowered.
She just seems really, she's very interesting. And like, she definitely, you know, went to bat against Tony Alamo and is like organizing, you know, like she's very much like telling her truth and she's excellent at it.
I mean, I don't expect you to answer this question, and I'm just going to, I don't even know why I'm saying it, but like, how do you hold accountable the followers that were so directly linked to abusing children also, right? Because they're brainwashed and they think it's for the better good and all this stuff, but they're just holding children and doing the beating, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that everyone was being sleep deprived and food deprived and worked to the bone, and everything was stripped away from them. And they were just living in this ideology that was everything. They gave up everything to raise their children.
Yeah.
In this way that they felt was like the best thing they could do for their children. And it just became like pathological, this like fear of going to hell and like, you know, needing that. I mean, I think if I went far enough in my own opinion, I would probably be like, I think that that's, you know, one of the dark sides of like most organized religions. I think like there's this sort of like scary side to a lot of that stuff, mm-hmm. that, you know, if people, if it gets into the wrong hands of people, it can be terrible. I remember in college, I went to a Jesuit university. So most of my teachers are priests. And one of the classes, you know, or what I heard often is like, the Bible is the world's greatest tool and the world's greatest weapon, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of classes were about like, when I went to school, from the Jesuit perspective, a lot of classes are about the way that people weaponize religion and how that's should be a huge part of like practicing religion is combating that, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which I always just thought was really interesting. I'm not religious, but I always kind of I thought that was the first time I heard a religious institution sort of saying that like part of being a like of this religion, practicing this religion, is combating the people that use it as a weapon.
Sure. Sure.
So, you know, in my feeling is like, I don't think it's that crazy that this guy was able to use this like,
sure.
you know, ancient piece of work that's influenced so much of our culture to scare a bunch of people into doing something terrible. I think people do it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, in various forms of social acceptability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, good job, Muriel. Look at you contributing to the Reddit mythology.
Hey, man.
You know what I mean?
If you're a Redditor and you like the same things I do, you'd be like, man, I heard this really great podcast. You should listen to it. Post it. Link me up, baby.
Hell yeah. So yeah, okay. Thank you for listening. Muriel did all the research, the writing. You know, she hosted this thing. I did all the engineering and recording and editing and all that kind of fun, boring stuff. This is just the two of us. We're in our apartment. You guys are listening wherever you are in the world at whatever point in human history you're hearing this. It's really amazing. We're so lucky to have you. So there's no advertising on this show. You know, we just do this. The only kind of money that we get is through people that subscribe through our Patreon or Spotify exclusive, or the crazy people that just send us something on Venmo. You know what I mean?
Tight.
We love you guys, man. That's cool too. But so anyways, we put out exclusive episodes, that are behind a paywall, and we do that because we want to get those sweet, sweet dollars for the work we put into the show. So we just put out a crazy two-parter. Takes place in Florida. It was just, it's all modern era stuff. And it's the story of Dahlia and Mike DiPolito. It was a two-parter. Muriel went off. It was crazy. We're going to play a little snippet of that in the hopes that you're like, oh, that's so, so good. Like, we have to sign up.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of good stuff on that Patreon, you know what I mean? Channel.
So, we'll be back next week, and, otherwise check us out on the exclusive feeds. And here's a little taste of a Muriel's Murders exclusive.
Muriel's Murder. Muriel's
Patreon
Murder.
Exclusive. Patreon exclusive.
Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murder. We are going to South Florida to talk about money, sex, murder for hire, and the hide of dumbassery. That's right. we're starting our two-part series on Mike and Dahlia DiPolito. I don't want to give too much away, but you will be totally flabbergasted by pretty much every major plot point of this story. Hold on to your butts.
Hell yeah. This is great. We're back. I've missed doing this.
Oh.
Yeah. I still hate true crime.
Uh-huh.
Still
keep going.
Very on the fence about you in general.
I know you're so mad at me right now.
It's very touch and go, but for some reason I do have openness and joy in my heart, and I like creating this podcast with you. We haven't recorded a true crime episode in a while now.
Yeah,
I've missed it, and I'm very, very much looking forward to whatever the hell is about to happen.
I can't believe it with all your attitude. All right, our main source for this episode is the book Poison Candy by Elizabeth Parker and Mark Ebner. Elizabeth Parker was actually a prosecutor in this case, and her book is really great, and she's pretty funny. And also very accurate and
respectful, accomplished professional.
Well,
person.
She did call this book Poison Candy. She does have like a flair for the like the juicy lips, something. I'm like, okay, lady.
juicy lips. What are you, Muriel Montgomery?
I also used reporting from Jill Cederstrom for Oxygen True Crime, and then I used the 2020 episode Down Payment on Death. Which, despite its stupid title,
on all these people.
It was a really good episode. Uh-huh. I thought it was like really accurate, and you got to really see interviews from people, which was cool.
So one title was Down Payment for Death.
On Death.
And the other one was Poison Candy.
Yeah.
Oh, this is very two different approaches. They had two very distinct ideas of what the big hook of this was. I wonder which one you're going with.
Well, I'm going with neither because I think it's all garbage, but I want to know which one you're going with. All right. This is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc., but you signed up for this, so it's your funeral.
We're going to joke. We're going to curse. And we're also going to love all of our people that signed up for this, these exclusive episodes. You guys give us the dough. We give you the bonus episodes. You make our dreams come true. You know what I mean? We're all on the spinning ball of chaos together. And we
will
love you
be
very much.
Shouting you out so soon.
Yes.
As soon as we start our main feed up again, which will be next week. So
yeah, it's coming right around the corner. We have so many shout outs to give.
Yeah, we're going to have to do like multiple part shout outs.
All right. Okay. Muriel, what happens next?
No. Okay, let's get started. All right, South Florida, circa 2008, land of dreams, palm trees, cocaine, hurricanes, boy bands, humidity, and ravenous insects. Here in this wonderland, Mike DiPolito was finally coming into his own. The boy they used to call White Boy Mike back in his hometown of Philly was now a super beefy, freshly sober ex-con rolling in cash after randomly finding work in the burgeoning new world of internet marketing, whatever that meant in 2008.
Okay, all right.
He had a loyal wife, a leased Porsche, and a disciplined
life. Oh my God.
Life.
I thought you just said that her name was Elise Porsche.
No, he had a loyal Porsche wife. That he leased.
I feel like someone has named their kid Elise Porsche without realizing what that actually.
Definitely. And I went to middle school with them, and.
And they're your nemesis. They bullied you. Okay. Sorry. What was the third thing in your thing? In your
Elise Porsche. and a disciplined life. He woke up every single morning at 4:30 a.m. to head to the gym. He had regular AA meetings, and generally, he kept his nose clean. Because you see, a few years earlier, Mike had been caught scamming old folks into buying worthless penny stocks as a part of a boiler room scheme. So kind of like how Wolf of Wall Street starts out, that type of like scammy thing, right?
Sure.
So he served about 2 years between jail and prison. And then after working out some plea deal thing, he got out of prison but was slapped with a $219,000 restitution payment and about 28 years of probation.
28 years of probation?
Yes. So
damn, like, that's like not even probation anymore.
Well,
that's,
he didn't have to go to prison, right, for what he did for very long, like only a year. So it's like kind of, I've seen it referred to in some articles as a sweetheart deal, but it wasn't that much of a sweetheart deal because he got 28 years of probation. So it's kind of like, oh, great. Well, you can, it's almost like house arrest.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Everything was looking up for white boy Mike. And then one night in October 2008, when Mike's wife, Maria, was out on a three-week vacation, Mike's business partner turned him on to the female escort directory, Eros.com.